Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on December 17th, 2024. And time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County Community Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Willenbrock, our Chief Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or electronic devices at this time. This session is for the board and our CEO to study and discuss issues among ourselves with the staff. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the public agenda? First up on our agenda is our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Commissioners. We have lots of good stuff on the agenda this morning, so we'll get right at it. First up in your board packet, there was the legislative update, and we have our government affairs folks here to answer any questions.
I did was really pleased with the continuation of good reads and that sort of thing. Very, very thorough.
Yeah, you do a fantastic job.
I was happy to see that we're going to be hiring a lobbyist for federal.
Yeah, and we're very close. I don't know if. Yeah, we're very close. I put you on the spot, but I know this is something Kim's very excited about. So
we're actually talking about two different things. Oh, okay. We do have a federal lobbyist on contract. That's Vanessa Feldman. That we will be renewing that contract. They do a lot of help with work out in DC, and then we'll be adding a person to our team to do federal work full time. To become clear that there's a need for real education on hydropower and all of the good stuff that we do. And I think that bringing someone on that can be dedicated just to that work full time will be a huge benefit to us.
Sorry, Kim, my mistake allowed you the opportunity to talk about the position you're so excited about.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Any other questions?
I don't know. Any other questions?
No.
Right. Next up, we're going to have Mark Fleury and Aaron Janasco give a overview of our bomb cyclone event around before Thanksgiving,
the first one.
Yeah. Good morning, Aaron, Mark.
Good morning, Commissioners. Aaron Janasco, Senior Manager of Regional Design and Construction Services. And we're here to share kind of a recap of the large storm we had back in November. Agenda. So again, the storm kicked off on the 19th. Winds really started to ramp up. It was a predicted storm. We were prepared. We had communicated with mutual aid the day prior, as well as the day of, and had logistics ready to go if we needed to pull the trigger. We're always a little bit shy to call too early because you never know if the wind's really going to blow. But in this case, it definitely did. And around 7 o'clock that night, we really saw a ramp up in the wind. And even by 10 p.m., we had crews in the field, and we actually called a safety stand down in the middle of the night and asked everybody to get out of the air. Trees were coming down around our folks, and so we got down and took a timeout for a little bit. So it was a good call. The wind speeds, what was interesting with this is all of the forecasts we were seeing were talking about winds in the mid-40s. And it actually exceeded expectations, and we saw winds between 52 and 70 miles an hour. What was also unique about this wind with that cyclone that was blowing off the coast, as it wrapped around and came into our mountains, it created an easterly wind, which we don't typically see too far into our service territory. So those trees weren't used to that. And that's in addition to why we saw the damage that we saw. And we'll share some of those pictures here in a little bit. Impacts. This storm, not as high customer outage as we've seen in the past, but we did have 166,000 plus out. Talked about the wind there. What was interesting here is we did have widespread damage across our territory, but definitely an emphasis in the whole Lake Rossiger, Machias, Snohomish, that whole area. Things that stood out to me being out in the field, and John can attest as well, oftentimes you'll see a tree come down and create a large outage. We were seeing 5 and 10 and 20 trees all for one outage. And so just multiplies the amount of work that had to be done to get restoration done. And we'll show some data on that here in a little bit.
Yeah, I'll pile on to that. I had the opportunity to go out and visit some crews and hang out a little bit. The damage in that area that Aaron just described reminded me much of the when we would get a tornado in the Midwest, and how it just doesn't matter how big, how sturdy those trees are, that way it and in that way it just rips and tears, and it just looks like an absolute areas that makes the work that much more complicated. So
it was interesting too. You'd go drive along, like, okay, Mill Road, for example, there was a forest away from our power. The entire forest is on the ground right now. But then you drive another block or two and you'd see nothing. But then a little bit farther, another pocket. So never seen that before. But the damage, again, just absolutely incredible.
I think that was the cyclonic effect.
Yes.
Because that's how cyclones are really weird.
Yeah, absolutely.
After hurricanes on the East Coast, we would then have cyclones.
Oh.
That would come in, and whatever hadn't been destroyed before, that, you know, that would take care of it. But I was wondering on the pole, not the trees, but on the poles that broke, if we could afford a different kind of pole, what would we choose, and how would it be affected?
Well, we do use ductile iron poles on anything over 65 feet. Uh-huh. There is a cost element to it for sure. There's also a philosophy around what they call hardening your system for engineering wise. And there's debates there, but if you go too far hardening your system and you get the kind of damage, you'll actually end up with more damage if it all does come down. So there's kind of a balance there of the pole coming down versus more cross arms, et cetera. That's probably a conversation for another day, but the cost piece, like for example, on our distribution system, most of our wood poles are 45 feet tall. A 45 foot wood pole is about $1,200. A ductile iron pole is $3,200. So they're almost triple the cost. Sure. So
thank you.
But they are, I will say the ductile is kind of newer to the industry in the last handful of years. And we have adopted and incorporated a lot of those, again, especially in our transmission system. So right off the bat there on the storm, we did have 14 of our own district line crews, 19 service crews, and also two vegetation management crews. And we'll get into the mutual aid data here in a second. We did get, as we were getting see the numbers rise, we did initiate mutual aid. And there was some philosophy or strategy behind that with timing of rest and when they could get here and trying to get the most hours and to be effective. So. Here's a list of the mutual aid crews from across the state. We pulled resources from everywhere. So we've got, I've got some thank yous for you to get to, John. We got those done. We'll be sending them letters personally from John and their appreciation. We also 15 contract tree crews from three companies, Aspelin, Davy, and Kemp West. Great partnerships with them.
I had a question about the contract. Go back that one slide to the contract tree crews.
Yep.
So I'm surprised that so many crews are available at the last minute. How does that work? Do they come off other contracted work, do this, or?
They do. So we have, so the Asplund crews, for example, we actually have them as a dock crew. So they're on our property already.
Oh, okay.
In addition to ours. Davy and Kemp are the other two main players in our area. Not all, but we have a lot of tree contracts out right now. And when we write those contracts, whether it be for tree trimming or maybe if it's a line crew for doing batter holes, for example, we write in the contract, if there's a storm, we have first right of refusal. So it's leverage. So typically we try to strategize contracts in the winter to have an upper hand on having resources.
Okay, that makes sense. I was wondering, how did we get these crews and the other utilities didn't?
Well, they did too.
Did they? Okay.
PSE had a lot of crews. I can't remember the numbers, but they had a lot of resources.
I was thinking it was fortunate that we weren't having the same problem statewide.
Yes, very much so.
Really in trouble.
We were fortunate. A couple of the mutual aid crews from farther west, like Grace Harbor and those, they didn't get it as bad. So they were cleaned up within a day or two, and then they were offering us resources. So from a strategy standpoint, it worked out very well with staggering crews and having resources available every night. So it was good. Just some pictures from the storm here. Got a few to scroll through. Again, the damage was just...
Can you go back one slide?
Absolutely.
I mean, we're just so fortunate nobody got killed. That SUV was apparently nobody was in it.
No, they weren't, to my knowledge. I do have a personal story. A friend of mine lives not too far from John. Well, John knows him. He had two trees come down into his house, and he was sitting in the living room. One stopped about this far above his head.
Ooh.
So just incredible.
But there was one man in the Seattle area, and he said, after this was the previous storm, the other big one, he said he had his wife on one side and his elm tree on the other. Just that close.
Yeah, we also had a water employee, water utility employee, like the same thing. Tree came down in their house, and they luckily weren't in that area, but yeah.
It's just incredible that we didn't have any injuries, this all of that work.
Jason, Chief Energy Resource Officer, on that specific car that was out on the Sultan Basin Road, and there was, I think it was four vehicles went up there the night of the storm, and, you know, they all just got crushed, and the people in them walked out. Our crew went up there and, you know, found them the next day. So fortunately, yeah, no one got injured, but good reminder, know the weather, don't go out in the woods when it's, you know, that
yeah.
sort of thing coming in.
Thanks, Jason. Yeah, wow. Just I don't think this is the video. This is a video. I think it plays later. This was a situation. Our major yard was out, and you see the Traco there, and they'll actually lift that whole root wall about roughly 30 feet in diameter, believe it or not. But we'll get to that in a little further. Yeah, and just the...
Are they able to salvage any of those trees for lumber?
Some folks did. Out off of Menzel Lake Road, there's a Boy Scout camp, and
right.
the damage was so bad there, we went in to fix it, and they actually asked us to stay back for a few days. They brought in a lumber company and logging trucks,
Ooh.
Logged all the logs, and then we went back in and restored power. So,
yeah. We saw that as revenue.
Yeah, I was just
going to
say that.
This was we only had a couple of transmission outages this go around. This particular one did have a pull down. This was down in the Linwood area in a big right of way. And so you can see the amount of wire and damage. Our folks going to work. And access was also very difficult. Again, I'll go back to the OK Mill Road because our crews went in there. Trees were coming down behind them, and they had to cut their way out for hours just to get back out. It was just so many trees. I think this is the video. There we go.
Wow.
I wish I could say we were replanting.
Can you do that again?
Who's controlling it?
Wow.
That's really amazing video.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. So again, some data for you with all of the crews we had on property, including ours, in 6.5 days, 42,000 hours worked, and most proud of the fact of no injuries. We did have one employee go through some dehydration after a meal, but in terms of injury on the field, zero. So very impressed.
Anything to that? I mean, these are multiple days, long hours, rough conditions. And the testament to when the person was struggling, you know, dehydration, crew rallied around, noticed it, took care of him, And it elevated the, you know, kind of the awareness around looking out for each other in these kind of conditions even more so. But it zero injuries is phenomenal. All the things that go on every day, long nights on the cruise and looking out for each other, taking care of each other, that's a big deal.
They sneak up on you.
And these guys have set the environment for folks to know that that's what matters the most.
Absolutely. It can really sneak up on you.
Mm-hmm.
And dehydration. Obviously, with the amount of outages, there's a lot of generators running, potential for backfeeds. I mean, there's just so many recipes for disaster. So very proud of our folks for going the extra mile on that.
Is that a pole on the right? Is that one of the steel poles?
Pardon me?
Is that one of the steel poles on the right?
That looks like a fiberglass pole to me, but I could be wrong.
Yeah.
It might be ductile. That's actually got what they call legs or posts on it. I'm not sure where that one came from. I could find out though. Yeah, that is a climber. We don't typically climb when we joke that we're going to get magnets and put it on their hooks and climb under
them. Well, dang it, I don't think that's a good idea.
One of 366 swords.
I guess there's a video attached to that. Forward here. Here we go. All right. So here's some data from this storm, and then we'll show some comparisons from past years. Talked about the number of outages, number of service jobs and crew jobs. What was impressive here, 112 transformers, 43 of which were oil spills, which is roughly 20 more than we've ever had. You can see the amount of actual wire replaced. But along with that wire, 22 miles of wire, what's also impressive is that 6,074 wire splices. That is a lot of splices. 102 poles replaced. And again, I'll compare to 2022 here in a minute. I believe we were at 70 or 80. So you can see the damage was that much greater for less customers, but just a ton of work. Again, cross arms, insulators, and cutouts.
And kudos to our supply chain, our warehouse folks.
Stuck into our inventory though, and the need to.
So for some things, yes, like the insult, or it should be the.
I'm sorry, John, I interrupted you.
No, that's, yeah.
Splices, we are, I'd say a little low, but to John's point, our warehouse, Claudio and his team, they were on it. We got nervous there one night. We had stuff the next day. Okay. And so we were in great shape. We do have neighboring utilities if worse came to worse, but overall we're in a good place. And same with transformers. We've got a abundance of overhead transformers, so we're in a good place there.
Okay. Aaron, can you go back to the previous slide? I've got a few questions. So 112 transformers replaced. Are these damaged because they were on a pole that went over, or they're overloaded, or a combination of?
It's usually trees come down, hit the pole wire, pole goes over, hits the ground. And 43 of them are transformer spills. It's usually trees coming down, either hitting the wire, which pulls on the transformers, it can break the bushings, come to the ground and break open. There's a lot of things, but yeah, they're getting damaged.
So the other question is 22 miles of wire. Do we recycle that wire? Can the wire be repurposed? Or
we do. Out at Operations Center, we've got huge dumpsters that we do recycle. Actually, I wouldn't say recycle, but we can turn it in and get whatever the going rate is.
Right. Thank you.
So comparisons from the last couple of large storms we've had. And the things that stand out to me are the number of poles, because obviously when you're doing a new pole, it's that much more work, right? And so you can see 2022, we had 70 poles. This go around, we were at 102. Then same thing with the comparison on transformers. Just it's one thing to go out and put wire up, but then you add the added layers of poles and transformers and that much more time. And again, proud of everyone's work to do this in 6.5 days.
Aaron, we had a storm, I want to think it was like 15 years ago. I remember Stanwood Bryant Road. It looked like someone had taken toothpicks and just sort of dropped it over the road. The poles, so many poles, the trees are down. And those pictures sort of remind me of that. Was that storm, I don't know which storm that was.
You're spot on, yeah.
That similar damage or?
I would say this, well, This was worse in a concentrated area.
Okay.
That storm I remember as well was more widely spread, but same principle. It was just so congested in this area. But our dispatch centers and our what we call our major equipment yard, they do a great job. They, as we find out about these jobs and know there's poles, we've got pole trailers loaded and they're delivering them. So when the next crew gets that job, the pole's already there waiting for them, ready to go. And that was some good feedback we actually received from our mutual aid folks. Like, they couldn't believe, wow, the pole's already here, kind of thing. Just trying to be as efficient as we can. So any other questions on?
You know, a question about damaged poles. You know, I'm not sure what the chemicals are used to treat those poles. Are those toxic waste, or how do we deal with the waste product?
There's a few
physical poles.
Depending on the vintage, depends on what the chemical is. We can give the poles away if we're adjacent to a homeowner that meets the fence post. We can cut that and give them that pole. The alternative is we have to bring them back, cut them up, put them into containers and take them to landfill, which is frustrating because they are good fence posts. It's labor and more hazard using chainsaws. We're actually looking to buy a piece of equipment that's basically scissors with it on a track hoe to make it quick to cut these up, because they will only take them in small pieces. So,
yeah. Thank you.
Just some kudos from the community. This was from Machias Elementary. They came out and found one of our crews and featured it with what they did in class, so that was pretty cool. And just some social media posts from folks in public as well, and really appreciate our corporate communications team. Appreciate our corporate communications team. We were really close together, and really just trying to communicate to the public and give as much information as we can to keep them notified, and really developed into a great partnership.
You're a special breed. Some people
And then this was some feedback we received, again, back to our warehouse folks. Mutually reached out to us, and just they were very impressed with how organized the warehouse is, and I've got a smile on their face and ready to go. So pretty cool.
It's impressive how we were able to really empower those mutual aid crews. Like, it's not normal from some of the responses heard from them that they don't always encounter that.
And there's a whole other added layer too. We're a larger utility. We've got a full-blown energy control center. There's a lot of protocols in place with working on power lines, right? And a lot of these smaller utilities, they don't have that. They're used to just going out in the field, put their tag on the pole and go to work. And so you add that added layers that we have in the name of safety for good reason.
Yeah.
It's a lot of different pressures and complexities. And so we send what we call crew guides out with them, and again, try to be organized and communicate. And again, that all leads into why we had zero injuries. So I think that's it.
Really quick to, I mean, Aaron and Mark's leadership was outstanding throughout the whole event. All the folks that are involved, many of which are behind the scenes. I mean, the blowing crews are out, you know, and we have folks from the garage who are doing flagging, from substation they're out. Amazing, amazing work. Communications folks, as I expressed to you in the updates, I mean, they absolutely hit it out of the park with some of the new processes and procedures to communicate with our customers. And those are the kind of things that just, you really kind of win the day, so to speak, with your customers. Mm-hmm. If you can manage that, the media, and manage the social media, it makes a big difference. And that also then encourages, when we're getting good feedback, and there's always a grumpy customer or two, and absolutely understand if you're out for multiple days, that gets, you know, annoying. But the by and large, the comments were so positive, and that feeds everybody that's out working the storm.
Right.
And it's really fun to see and how much pride our folks have in being able to go out in these kind of conditions and serve our customers and all the things that are going on behind the scenes. So it's just a huge kudos to the entire team and entire organization and how well they facilitated this restoration process.
Yeah, and I think we made great use of television news too.
Yeah, exactly.
People wanting information, wanting to do a story, and we gave them access to
our
different people in the organization doing the work.
Yep.
Oh, I like that too.
It makes it very personal.
Yep.
They were in stores.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people might want to move to Snohomish County.
Well, we do have folks that live outside our territory that often comment about, we wish we were in your territory. Dangerous property available.
Bonham was a good example.
Well, we actually have somebody on our executive team that is awful on the wrong side of
the wrong side of the track.
See where he moves if he ever comes back.
Yeah.
Anything else for me?
No.
Any questions, Christian?
Where they were, and as I said, they're a different breed. Well,
anyways, yeah.
I think that is a full compliment.
Yeah. All right.
That's great. I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great job, Aaron. All right. Next up, we have Kevin Lahren with a update on our Snow Smart program. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, John. Morning, Commissioners.
Morning.
My name is Kevin Lahren, Program Director for the Snow Smart Program. We were last here in August providing a program update. And the purpose of today's commission presentation is to provide the commission a short program update along with a contract that will be in the consent agenda this afternoon from TRC Engineering. So quick overview of our contract negotiations. And so we're requesting approval of that contract this afternoon.
Can you remind me, TRC stands for?
It's Transit Resource Center Engineering. They no longer use those words because I think it's a little different than what they do today, but that was their old name.
Okay, thanks.
You bet. So the agenda today is to provide an update on DOE and the program. Also to talk about the Advanced Distribution Management System, ADMS, cost estimate and contract, which is the TRC engineering contract. And then we'll talk a little bit about the scope and what we have included in the contract. So as far as DOE and program updates, so Department of Energy on 10/31, we had our first batch of quarterly reports. There's about 9 reports that we submit every quarter throughout the program, measures all aspects of our spending, our scope, our schedule. And so that was measuring 1 month's worth of work. As you remember, we just had this contract approved at that time. And so things worked well with that. On the very next day, on November 1st, we had our kickoff meeting with the Department of Energy and gave them a broad overview of the program and how we're going to use the team, how we're going to execute this program, how it's divided up. And so that meeting went very well. We have a very good relationship with the team at Department of Energy. We continue to have sync up meetings with them every other week as we're spooling up the program, new reports, information from DOE, that we are sharing with each other every other week. And as far as DOE is concerned, we asked them with the administration change, presidential administration change, and they said right now it's just business as usual. And so we're seeing strong support for this program from both sides of the aisle, so we're very encouraged by that.
Thank you for that information. I'm worried about that too.
Okay.
Is it common to have a meeting every 2 weeks with DOE and a grant like this? That really, I'm just surprised.
Yeah, I think it's right now we just both mutually decided on that. So it's not like it was required. We had to do that or requirement. Okay. We were thinking since it's brand new program, it's really for DOE side, it's new for them too. And all the reporting that we're doing. And so they're learning also. So we decided, hey, let's just meet every other week. And if we don't have any topics to cover, we can skip a meeting too.
Sure.
But we found them very useful. Yeah, you bet. As far as the program, a quick update on that. So the middle of November, the Enterprise Project Governance Board, EPGB, has a new project status reporting system, and we wanted to be one of the guinea pigs and start using that system. We're trying to use common tools within the program that the district uses right now. And so we just use those, and we're utilizing that system here on out to report status of each of the individual projects that comprise of the program. We also provided EPGB an update in November regarding an overview of the program, plus talking about all the resources, the employees that will be involved in this huge program. One of the things that we want to navigate is not over burdening any employees with too many projects. And so working with Doris Payne in reviewing the demand plan with her. And so she has a great view of how resources are utilized within key projects within the district. So we'll have good visibility of that. And if we see somebody being overutilized, we'll talk to the manager and try to figure out a strategy around that.
That's smart. That's great.
If we have team members that are fresh and energized, it's always more productive within a project. Yeah. All right. So the ADMS system, so cost estimates and contract. So I'm here with Sheila Crawford here, our senior project manager, or project manager four. It's a new title. She's doing a great job. A lot of work this year in the selection of PRC for our integrator for the ADMS and SCADA software. So about a year ago, Qualis, who's our owner's engineer, kind of like Z2 Solutions was on ConnectUp, we talked to them. They provided an estimate that this project would cost about $11 million for this project. DistribuTech earlier this year, a team was down there learning about which vendors had the software available. And based on discussions there, it was estimated that the contract would be about $12 to $15 million for this. Earlier, last summer, TRC Engineering was selected. We want to move forward with contract negotiations with them. Their pre-statement of work bid was $6.4 million, and that's kind of a bare bones scope that they had included in that bid. And this is the amount we shared with Department of Energy last fall, because it was the only number that we had. And they realized that we were still going through contract negotiations. It was just the lineup of things. They realized that there was going to be more to it. And so they understood that, and they know where we are today. So during the fall, the team did a very thorough review of this bid and identified some key areas that needed to be added to this package. Additional systems integrator, ConnectUp, we had a systems integrator that provided end-to-end service on the design and testing, had full visibility of the solution, and very, very useful to have one of those in a project like this. And so that was added to this contract. Also an energy management system. This was very important to ECC. And so that was added to our scope. An additional environment that I'll talk about in just a minute, and also additional time was required, 8 months in addition to the original pre-statement of work bid that TRC provided. So these additional items were $4.3 million. And so the project contract result was $10.7 million. So this still came in under the next qualifying bid. Theirs was about $1 million more before even looking, doing a statement of work review. So we were happy with that. And also within the Qualis estimate and DistribuTech estimate too. Then you'll also see in the pack this afternoon an additional $2.6 million, and that's for the maintenance and support contract outside of the project. So that's standard after year one. There will be an additional contract to support the software.
Yeah, I like the terms that you get on that.
Good. Thank you. Yeah, and really, Sheila Crawford and the team did all the work. So I'm just the mouthpiece today. All right, so a little bit deeper dive into the contract. So we extended the schedule an additional 8 months. So why did we do that? There was a tight schedule that was in the original bid, and learning from ConnectUp, we needed to really pivot our timing to avoid storm season. And so that added additional time to the project and gave us more of a little bit more breathing room to be successful. As I mentioned earlier, systems integrator who will be responsible for the end-to-end integration of this system, very key for such a complex project like this. We also have an additional non-production environment, and that will allow us, so we talked about reclosers and other equipment that's going to be out in the field. We want to be able to test that in a safe environment, not in production, and so that's what this environment is all about, to test our SCADA with these switches. Additional time for testing, again, that was a ConnectUp lessons learned, where we wanted to test thoroughly one time and expose as many defects and debug as much as we can early, so that we're not debugging in production once we go live. And so that worked very well with ConnectUp, and so we're taking a similar approach with this project. Mentioned the EMS system, so the ECC was desiring a single pane of glass, and so that now includes the transmission information in a single application window, along with our distribution information, so they don't have to look from screen to screen for that. Viva Pi, so another project, Brad AC's managing this project, and so the integration work with that corporate historian project. And you'll be seeing that January or February timeframe, you'll be seeing that contract coming here for approval. We locked in, so Sheila's team locked in pricing for block pricing for SCADA points. And so that was seen as a big win, really an inflation mitigator there, being able to lock in pricing, and also years 6 through 11, as additional points are needed, there's a limit on how much those can increase by. So a big win there. And a similar type of terms for our maintenance and support work, fixed at a 3% renewal increase from years 6 through 11, so well beyond the project.
This is for design of the system and supplying the software, is that right?
Yes, correct. Yeah, TRC is the integrator, and then AspenTech is the software developer.
Okay, integrator meaning the ability to communicate. What does integrator mean?
Yeah, so it's taking multiple systems and helping them to talk to each other, being able to look at the whole entire solution as a whole. We might have different software modules and such, and so those have to be designed and configured. And so making sure everything works together.
So as they do this work, will our people be alongside? And when the project's done, will we understand how to go in and fix things, tweak things? Are we going to be responsible? Are we going to always have to have a contract to operate the system?
Right. Yeah, there will be, as much as we have control over, there will definitely be a transfer of knowledge for us. Sheila Crawford will have a training plan built around that. Also, we have a maintenance and support contract, so if there's problems with the software, we didn't design the software, so we'll have AspenTech to help out with that.
Okay.
Any other questions on this part? Okay, so next steps just within the program. So today you'll see in the consent agenda, the TRC Engineering ABMS contracts, so we're requesting approval of that. We also have the Aviva Corporate Historian contract that will be coming up. We have January here as a chance it might go into February, but for the next 2 months, you'll be seeing that contract come in the consent agenda. And also John Heeb, the distribution automation project, that's all the equipment, the sensors that will be installed in the field. We'll be having a purchase equipment approval request that will come in the first quarter. Most likely it's going to be early January that you'll be seeing that. And then we'll be providing quarterly updates on the program. Since we're here today, we'll probably push it out towards the end of the first quarter. So probably March timeframe at the latest, we'll give you our next update on the Snow Smart program.
Stan, about the corporate historian.
Yes.
Is that one person? I mean, who's, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, that the corporate historian is a software solution.
Okay.
That takes SCADA.
Okay.
Yes. And so that's going to take the SCADA data, and then it helps to distribute it to other systems within PUD that use that SCADA information.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Hey, any other questions?
Let's have negotiations.
Yes, thank you. Sheila and team did a great job.
They're tough.
Okay. Wonderful.
The commissioner also noticed how clean this truck is.
Yeah. This was. Yeah.
Oh, well, clean our equipment out there is.
Yeah, we shined it up just for this slide.
No, it's
we never used this truck.
This is
I
normal.
Don't know. I don't think to say anything.
Yeah, they are sharp.
Against others that provide a service in the county, but ours are stand out by far.
They do.
Well, I have to tell you, I got home last night. Dinner times, my wife said, we passed some PUD trucks. On our way with our errands today, and man, they looked dirty.
Yeah. Well, they might have been out working how many hours?
Well, I told her, she said, don't you have a way to clean those? And then they have to go out and actually get some work done. So sink you and my wife up.
Well, the ones I see are.
They usually are.
They don't. Yeah. They don't even have a spot of rust on.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they look very good.
Yeah, they definitely stand out.
Yeah.
It could be that your PUD phone, you're referencing where you are. That you're driving clean trucks. They have animals, and they drive it around. So like you, and I think this truck probably never does anything except get pictures.
Get pictures. That's our
picture. Love part of a master plan.
Yeah, right.
Well, it better not be just a picture truck. That's one heck of an expense.
It's Photoshop.
Thank you. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Good.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Great job, Kevin. Ready for a break or keep going?
Either way. Would you like?
Let's do one more.
That's what I was saying.
All right. Okay. Next up is Ian Hunter with our renewal request for proposals. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Ian Hunter, power analyst with the power supply department. I have to say I was a little nervous being on the schedule today with the presentations that preceded me, the phenomenal work that our storm team did. I don't have a video of anything tipping a 30-foot roof structure into a hole. I don't even have a clean truck. But we will talk about the renewal request for proposals today.
You are sufficient in and out of yourself.
So hoping to talk a little bit today, we're wanting to just give you an update for some awareness of an initiative that we're going to be doing in the power supply department. We're going to be going out and looking for renewable resources. We're going to be issuing an RFP, looking for some of those resources, and we're hoping to talk a little bit about what we're going to be hoping to accomplish with that, and then what's the process and what's the timeline. So a little bit of the why, a little bit of the what. And this is just for information. There's no decision required here. So what are our goals? We're really hoping to accomplish three things. One is to look out into the marketplace and try and identify places where we might be able to fulfill some of our regulatory compliance obligations. We've got some that we're subject to right now. We've got some coming up in the future. And so we want to make sure that we're positioned and prepared to meet those obligations. Second, we're really looking to get some market information. You know, we have some insight into the market right now, but putting out an RFP and seeing what is being offered and what's kind of real out in the market is extremely valuable information, and it helps support our 2025 IRP efforts. And then finally, you know, there's projects that are being built right now that are soliciting off-takers, soliciting project support. And so we want to make sure that if those projects are going right now, we don't miss the boat, so to speak. We want to make sure that as competition ramps up for some of these renewable resources, that we are positioned to take advantage of them and don't miss them.
First question.
What regional projects are in sight? Or?
Well, that's one of the goals of the RFP, is to find out what's actually out there. So we want to make sure that if there's something out there that we're not aware of, we get an offer for it. We then know that it exists and we can evaluate it for its specifics. And so one of the goals of the RFP is to answer that question exactly.
Well, the reason I ask is preserving the access. So assuming we have access or not.
Right. So the idea is, you know, if a project is being built and they're soliciting off-takers or soliciting partners, we don't want to not be aware of the project and then have others come in and fill up the participation when we would have potentially liked to have been part of that project as well.
Not be late to the game.
Exactly.
Right.
Yep. So we'll talk about all these goals a little bit more in depth on the next few slides. There's a little bit of review. I'm going to kind of step through these pretty quick. You're all kind of aware, you've heard these presentations before about our regulatory compliance obligations. We've got the Energy Independence Act right now that we're subject to. This is more colloquially known as I-937. It has a renewable portfolio standard aspect where we have to procure renewable energy or RECs in a certain amount. We have three ways we can comply. One is 15% of our total retail load met with renewable energy credits. The second is a no load growth standard. So if we don't have load growth over a certain period of time, we're considered to be in compliance with the act. And then the third way is the cost cap. So if we spend 2% or more of our total retail load on renewables, then that's considered in compliance. We've never used the cost cap methodology. We've primarily been the 15% renewable portfolio standard, but we did have a period of time during COVID where we took advantage of the no load growth.
So the 2%, that's on new renewables or not existing renewables?
New renewables. So yeah, you've got to make new investments, and that's what counts towards that cost cap. It's kind of 2%, you would be paying 2% more than you would have done had the law not gone into effect. CETA, which we're all familiar with, you got to be carbon neutral by 2030. You've got to be 100% clean by 2045. If we're 100% clean, though, in 2030, so we meet that CETA requirement early, we are automatically deemed to be in compliance with the EIA renewable portfolio standard. So it's kind of a fourth compliance pathway that becomes available to us in 2030. Our goal has always been 100% clean by 2030, just because of the reduced cost potential. Because CETA rules allow hydro resources, they consider them to be compliant with CETA, which is of the bulk of our portfolio. It allows us to not have to procure as many renewable energy credits for I-937 because hydro is not considered an eligible renewable under I-937. A little bit of a few numbers, just rough math here. We've got a total annual retail load of about 7 million, a little bit over, and we need about 1 million EIA eligible RECs per year in order to satisfy that 15% renewable standard. After 2028, you know, we have certain resources in our portfolio now that are rolling off over the next few years. And so our inventory in 2028 and after would be about 100,000 per year. There is a market for unbundled RECs, so if we wanted to comply to bridge that gap, we could go out into the marketplace and just buy paper RECs. But there's a little bit of a concern around supply because, you know, that's a big gap to bridge, and there may not be suppliers who could fill the whole thing all at once or even piecemeal it. So we just want to make sure that we're positioned in a place where we don't find ourselves needing in the marketplace when the marketplace doesn't have liquidity.
So in this RFP process, mm-hmm. we're looking for RECs.
We're looking for renewable energy.
I was going to say, we're looking for renewables.
Yes. Okay. So we expect to be 95% clean in 2030 without any further action. And that's under the CETA standards. It would take a bundled energy and REC contract of around 330,000 megawatt hours to reach 100% clean. So just for under CETA standards, we've got about 330,000 megawatts to go in order to reach that 100% target. That estimate is dependent, it's a forecast right now. It's dependent on what BPA's fuel mix is. It's dependent on what our load is. And so we can expect that number to change over time, depending on where our load goes and what Bonneville's fuel mix does. So that's the regulatory compliance piece. The next piece is looking at the IRP and helping to inform and get some market information. For 2025, we've got our comprehensive IRP that's coming up. It does require supply side resources to help establish what that long-term strategy is. And so while we typically source those from regional data sets, such as the Northwest Power Conservation Council, other IRPs, renewable energy labs, having an RFP gives additional and kind of more real market data that we can use. Not to say the other sources aren't real, but it gives us real-time data, I should say, that really helps refine those forecasts and the data that we've gathered. And then for BPA, we have some choices to make coming up regarding the new contract, especially around Tier 2. And so long-term Tier 2 pricing is expected to be comprised of some of these commercially available resources, like we would find in the RFP. And so being an active market participant right now will help inform some of the decisions we can make with regard to Bonneville in the future. And finally, competition for these resources is heating up. You know, that 2030 date is looming large in front of a lot of utilities. And so those utilities are going to need to grow their renewable portfolio as well in order to meet those standards. So as those projects become more subscribed, as the transmission system becomes more congested, we want to make sure that we're in on the ground floor, making sure that we have our needs met and our compliance obligations fulfilled. So that's the why and what we're hoping to accomplish. I'll pause right there if there's any questions on that before we jump into more of the nuts and bolts of the process and the timeline.
I have no question.
Okay.
I have a question. Yep. So since we're wanting energy and with the RECs, mm-hmm. I imagine there's a profile we like that energy, a shaping. So I'm guessing these RFPs are going to come back with solar projects and wind projects. Are we, is the RFP written in such a manner that we can choose among those options, not just on the cost, but also the potential shaping?
You just gave me the perfect segue into the next slide. The answer to that question is yes.
Okay.
So we're currently developing the RFP language right now internally. After it all gets reviewed internally, we're going to release it in early to mid-January, and we're going to have some parameters around what we're looking for. We're looking for up to 200 megawatts nameplate of new renewable resources. We're looking for it to be CETA eligible, and we're looking for commercial operation date around 2029. As part of our evaluation process, we would be looking at things like capacity factor, things like resource shape, whether or not it's a power purchase agreement or whether they're looking for an equity share in the project itself. All of these are going to be factors that are considered in the RFP. And when we get to the analysis piece, that's what we would be helping to rank these projects and stack them up against each other to see what is the best fit for us. Because you might have a really cheap resource that doesn't fit our load profile at all,
right,
and you have to stack that up against something that might be a little more expensive, but you know, meets our needs on the load side a little bit better. So that's part of the analysis that we're going to have to undertake.
So what states are will be CETA eligible? Can we get power from Montana, for instance?
We can get power from Montana. The footprint of I-937, or the EIA, is as defined as what's considered the Northwest in the Bonneville Power Act. And that's you know, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, there's some Montana, there's a little bit of, I think, I want to say Wyoming in there, or maybe Utah, sorry. I think a little bit of like Northern California. So it's a broad geographic footprint in the Northwest, but we're looking for resources that are EIA eligible, which fit into that geographic footprint.
One thing that's interesting to me, having lived through the I-937 era, is that one of the main purposes of it was to encourage more renewable energy in our region. So that's really very consistent with the original reason for creating it.
Yep.
And it was an initiative, as you know.
Yes.
But after it was passed, it was called the EIA.
Right. Yes.
It's not. It was no longer an initiative in January when it got passed.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of people know it as I-937 and not the Energy
Act. Yeah.
I have to catch myself. Even in this presentation, I've been referring to it as I-937. Okay, I think really, it is the Energy.
We understand both.
Yeah.
And another presentation I wanted to commend was study my packet. I think it was Saturday. I mean, you know, you took me step by step by step. Very helpful for me.
Good. Thank you. Just a few more of the steps on the actual RFP. We'd be looking for proposals to do back towards the end of January. We'd be evaluating them in February, and then we'd be hoping that, you know, we'd be able to come back to the commission with any viable proposals that we'd like to act further on. We're not requiring ourselves to take any proposals if none of the proposals meet our needs. So we're not saying, you know, we will absolutely pick something. We're saying it needs to fit our needs and it needs to be the right choice for our customers. And so we want to make sure that any proposal that we do select meets those criteria. So we could pick one, several, or none.
Your options open.
Exactly.
Questions, commissioners? Great presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, fantastic job. You.
So it is now 9:57. Let's take a break and come back at 10:05. All right, 10:05. We're back.
All right. Next up, Next up is our 2025 water general retail rate proposal, and Christina Art, who is joining us virtually. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning. Hopefully you can hear me okay.
Yes, hear you well.
Perfect. Good morning, commissioners. Christina Art, manager at the Water Utility. Apologize for having to do this virtually today. I just feeling under the weather, so decided to keep it away from everybody. Today, we are going to go ahead and go through the 2025 Water General Retail Rate Proposal. We're just here to brief you today on the retail rates. There's no action today. We'll be coming to you in January 2025 for a public hearing and action on the water general retail rate increase, which would be effective March 1st. And then also in January, we'll be coming with a consideration of a resolution for the pass-through of the City of Everett cost increase, which would be effective February 1st. Today's discussion, we're going to go through just a little bit of background, the drivers impacting water rates, summary of findings, such as the revenue requirement and cost of service analysis that we reviewed once again this year, and then our water general retail rate recommendation. This graphic we showed last year, both in December and January, and it is depicting where we thought we would be forecasted to land and a look forward when looking at things about a year ago, remaining on a fairly conservative path. These graphs were also showing previously the revenue requirement forecasted as of December 2023. And without action, we were seeing that we would be deficient in 2024 and outlying years with that continued growth, risking any capital investment and maintenance work that needed to be done. And at the time, the forecasted increases also looked to resolve these differences and maintain the time period's fiscal targets, such as what was then the 90-day cash on hand and conservative approach, as well as debt service coverage, among a few others. When looking at the revenue requirement, we also looked at the cost of service for each customer class, which we've been doing since about 2017, 2018. And at the time, the results did indicate a continued phase-in approach, which we utilized for 2024 based on prior board discussions. And the 2024 rates were then applied, as you see here on this graph, to bring all classes in line to paying their equitable fair share of costs. The results at the time also did indicate that interclass adjustments would not be needed beyond 2024, but we maintained the right to be able to review and monitor those, which we did again this year. Many drivers impact the water rates, but some of the larger ones were that we do see are the continued increase of purchased water rates from the City of Everett. The City of Everett cumulative rate increases since approximately 2018, including the currently proposed increase for 2025, have totaled just shy of 40% of the cost of wholesale water. Since purchased water does account for approximately 25 to 30% of our operation and maintenance costs, the City of Everett rate increases specifically since 2020 have realized an approximately 9% burden on our O&M costs that we have not historically passed through. In the fall, we did come to the board with a resolution to begin treating that impact of the cost increases as a pass-through, similar to that of the BPA and separate of our water general retail rate. We also see supply chain issues, inflation rates continue to go up, regulatory requirements and system growth driving our increased costs. We have a continued emphasis on our main replacement program out through 2031. We're seeing labor cost increases both for water and our shared services. In 2025, we are looking to add a few new FTEs. The water utility has not actually added any new FTEs in over 10 years. Some of the other labor costs, we did end the contract with TrueCheck, which was aiding in our monthly meter reading. However, those costs are now going to be realized in shared services as we've brought all of that in-house. We have a continued increase in those administrative costs, such as the meter reading, but those are all labor costs for work that is being done from the electric side for the water utility to benefit the water utility. And then we also have an enhanced look at our fiscal policy targets. We did adjust our days cash on hand. We have increased that to 150 days. And within the next 5 to 6 years, we are going to be progressing toward that 150 days. This graphic is showing where our water rates have been with historical inflation. As you can see, we are typically under, primarily focusing on our single family, which is a majority of our customers. And the assumptions in here being the proposed water general retail rate increase, the also proposed City of Everett pass-through, and an average inflation rate of 3.5% over the years 2025 out through 2030. This slide was originally based on information that we were given by City of Everett approximately 6 months ago. That data has been updated, but there was minimal impact to the 2025 amount that you see here. Currently, the City of Everett proposes increases that would increase the cost to us to be about $2 in 2025 and upwards of $2.26 in 2028. And it does appear that the City of Everett plans to take action on January 8th with a February 1st effective date for 2025. Since 2008, we have replaced approximately 21.5 miles of our aging water mains at a cost of just shy of $30 million. And we are currently budgeted to be on track to replace another 4,100 feet of aging main in 2025. About 70% of our aging mains in our system have been replaced since 2008, with just shy of 13 miles of aging main left to be replaced. And again, we are aiming to have that completed by 2031. Our Lake Stevens wells, we continue to attempt to maximize to be able to reduce the cost of purchased water that we purchase from the City of Everett. Since startup in 2012, we've produced just shy of 4 billion gallons for distribution into our system, which is about 18.5% of our total Lake Stevens system needs. And to date, we have saved approximately 7.5 million of those purchased water costs. This graphic is just depicting our overall current costs for administrative shared services with the electric side, as well as any forecasted. The current forecast is actuals through November plus projected for the ending of the year.
Question about this slide.
Sure.
I'm concerned at the rate increase we're recommending, and I'm trying to understand how much of that, what is it, 10¾% proposed, is because of the increased administrative costs that essentially electric is charging the water utility. Do you have any thoughts about, I don't know, what does 1% yield in dollars rate increase?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
What does 1% rate increase, how many dollars does that yield? I'm trying to compare those dollars to this graphic and how much this is going up.
Sure. I don't have the dollars right in front of me, but roughly with our internal labor and supplies, both internal labor being water labor and then the shared costs, it's about 5% of the increase on inflationary.
And I can weigh in, if allowed here, 1% of revenues is about $150,000 for the water utility.
Can you repeat that? And can you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Brooke Tasha with FCS, and I'm here in aid of Christina. Have been helping with the rate model over several years. So just to answer the question in terms of what 1% increase gets us on the water utility, that's about $150,000.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah.
Here we're going over the water system capital, over what we've been doing in 2024, a little bit of historical, but what we're looking at in the next few years, 2025 and beyond. We have a pretty robust capital plan to aid in many aspects of the water utility and our efforts in the main replacement program, updating SCADA at many of our sites, deploying the AMI meters and modules, replacement of a roof, putting out approximately 10 hydrants in our Warm Beach system to aid in water quality, construction of new reservoirs for redundancy and reliability, among many other projects. And the capital right now for 2025 is estimated at about $14 million. And this slide depicts where we're going, how we're going to be paying for that, whether it's going to be rate funded, bond funded, or GFC. We are also anticipating a couple of future debt issuances out in 2026 and 2029 to help aid in some of those capital projects. Typically, with the rate setting process, there are three main steps, which I know you've been going in depth with on the electric side. The first of those being the revenue requirement, where work is being done to determine the amount of revenue needed to satisfy the financial obligation of the utility. And we look at both direct and indirect expenses, direct being those operational costs and debt service, indirect being the maintenance of our policy targets, such as our days cash on hand. We then look at the cost of service analysis, or COSA, also known as an equity evaluation, where we determine whether or not each class of service is paying their allocated fair share of those costs. And then finally, we look at a rate design and determine how to collect those targeted revenues through fixed or variable costs. Right now, we're not proposing any changes really to that third step for the water utility. So our focus for 2025 specifically was on the first two steps. This is just depicting our rate strategy guidelines for 2025 and forward. And as of note, you'll see that the debt issuances in 2026 and 2029 are currently anticipated to be about $10 million and $5 million. And then we're also ramping up our days cash on hand to be able to hit that 150 in the next 5 to 6 years. Within our rate strategy forecast, we're showing that the water general rate increase for 2025 is proposed at 8.25%. We are also isolating out the City of Everett pass-through component just to show the overall rate impact. Concentration, though, right now is for the water general retail rate increase, but we are pointing out the City of Everett pass-through of 2.5%. That City of Everett pass-through that we are proposing and bringing to you in January for action is to aid in the cost impact of the over 8% City of Everett rate increase on commodity filtration and surcharge, as well as an additional increase in their monthly meter fees that we will be realizing as of February 1st, which is totaling just shy of a 10% increase in for all. The water general rate increase of 8.25 plus the City of Everett pass-through would ensure helping the debt service coverage and days cash on hand targets are met, capital projects are completed, main replacements continue to move forward, regulatory requirements are met, and that we continue to build a water utility workforce for the future to aid in continuing to provide safe, reliable, quality water to our communities. Future rate increases are forecast here. But again, we will determine that as we approach those dates. Our focus right now is 2025. And when we review those annually, we include updates to revenue generation, expense trending, any new hires, regulatory requirements, City of Everett increases, and our capital execution rates. Bringing the slide back around, this has now been updated to summarize the new look at the revenue requirement and revised forecasts, fund balances, and changes in its expense projections. We continue to feel impacts of our supply chain and other costs, and we do see deficiency trends impacting our ability to maintain any rate funded capital work, excuse me. The forecasted rate path has increased, and we do show that need for an 8.25 water general retail rate increase in 2025 with potentially similar increases in the outlying years. But again, our focus today would be 2025. And to put the 8.25 into perspective, along with the 2.5 pass-through, it would result in an increase of $5.60 to a typical residential monthly bill, which is about $2.78 more than what we projected about a year ago. Currently, for the March 2025 retail rate recommendation, we also made a lot of progress toward our rate equitability since 2018. So at this time, we are not recommending any cost of service changes for 2025, and that we would apply the water general rate increases equally to all classes of service, and then once again revisit that COSA annually. The slide is just depicting our forecasted rate schedule, showing our existing rates, as well as our proposed 2025 rates in green.
A question about this slide.
Yes.
So if I do the math for single family residents, I think they'll look familiar. So if the commodity rate is increasing about 10%.
Yes.
But we're only passing on a 2.5%. Cost of the price of water going up. Can you talk about the difference between that 2.5% and the 10%? Why is more of it not going into the fixed charge?
It should be going into both the monthly customer fixed charge as well as the commodity rate. But 2.5 as well as the 8.25 does impact both. In this slide, we are showing some sample bill impacts based on those rate adjustments, and the variations are driven by their monthly water usage, The rates are also reflective of equal increases across all classes.
Can you go back to the previous slide again, slide 18? Sorry.
Yeah.
So you're right. The math is exactly the same. The customer charge is going up by almost the exact same number, like 10.6, 10.7%. And I guess, you know, keeping with the Bonneville theory, we, you know, when we pass through a Bonneville increase, it all goes to energy, even if we are sort of lagging behind how much we should be charging that fixed cost. And I'm wondering if, of course, most customers aren't going to look at their bill and understand the difference, but I'm wondering if the fixed cost should go up more and the commodity should go up less. And my concern is, you know, when we talk about the impact to customers, that's the average impact, but some customers may have very large families, they cost the showers, and so their cost could be higher. So I'm just curious about that strategy.
We haven't currently looked at that strategy yet, but I see Jeff stepping up to the podium, so I'll let him chime in as well.
Jeff Kallstrom, Chief Water Operations Officer. I'll just add a couple pieces. I think part of it is that the cost that the district incurs, so not just the 2.5% from the city of Everett, but part of the 8.25% is related to providing service, so additional chemical. Additional water quality work, additional maintenance on the system, that sort of thing that is related to the usage that an individual customer would place on the system. And so that's why you're going to have more than just the city of Everett's pass-through applied to the commodity rate. If we took the, if you break them in half and take just the 2.5% and apply it entirely to the commodity rate, then we would actually have a larger increase on the commodity rate and a lower increase on the monthly charge. So it's a, yeah, you know, as we learned with, you know, talking with Peter and Christina, there is a little bit of art as well as science to this. And so, but that is the thinking, is that, you know, the costs imposed on the system are a combination of fixed costs just because it exists, as well as the usage that that particular customer places on the system.
So you're saying essentially the COSA recommends this.
Correct. So we've, over time, the work that Peter and Christina are doing on the electric side, the water utility started that a number of years ago, working with FCS.
Right.
And so we've kind of moved to the point now where the COSA is showing that we're about at equilibrium. And so as a result, the COSA is showing standard increases across both the commodity and the fixed charge, the customer charge, as well as across rate classes. But again, you know, as we've seen, there is a little bit of art in that as well. So,
thank you.
We also take a look at how we compare with other utilities and their anticipated rate increases. We have many utilities that are anticipating increases ranging from 2 to 15% in 2025. And our proposed increase with both the water general increase as well as the City of Everett pass-through would not actually drastically change our position with the majority of our neighboring utilities. And this is based on an average monthly single family bill of 700 cubic foot a month. So right now for 2025, we have a water retail rate recommendation. Beyond the City of Everett pass-through of 2.5%, which would be effective February 1st, we are proposing a water general retail rate increase of 8.25% effective March 1st, and that these rate increases would be applied equally for all classes of service. And at this time with next steps, we would come back on January 7th with a public hearing on the 2025 water utility general retail rate increases, as well as January 7th, we would be coming for board action on the City of Everett pass-through. In January, on the 21st, we would then come back looking for board action on 2025 water utility general retail rate increases. Again, February 1st is when City of Everett pass-through would take effect, and March 1st, for the 2025 water utility general retail rate increase. Throughout the year, we would then continue to revisit the cost of service any connection charges, wholesale rates. And then once we are able to get a lot more data out of our AMI meters and modules, we'd be looking to revisit a conservation rate to see if it makes sense for the utility. And I'm open for any other questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. On slide 5, we talk about drivers that could drive up the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so tariffs would be one possible driver at the federal level, and we're going to be needing
yes.
supply chain issues.
Yes.
If we have big tariffs, 10, 25%, whatever, that could really have an impact on our costs for all the things that need to be replaced going forward. So that's one thing. And then kind of related to this, if we have tariffs, I've heard that inflation is going to go up. So on slide 6, you say 3.5% inflation rate assumed. But on slide 14 in your chart, it's 3%. So which is it, 3 or 3.5? What I mean,
those are averages. We are seeing right now closer to a 3, but in looking at the outlying years, it's closer to an average of 3.5.
Okay.
However, you're correct. If those tariffs do come through, that will increase our inflationary pressures.
Now, commissioners, my concern is really a double-digit increase in a single year. And I don't want to slow down our progress on building our system up and staffing appropriately. But, you know, there's two parts of it. We're trying to increase our reserves, and we're trying to increase the water district's fair share of overhead and administrative costs. And I'm wondering if there's a slightly shallower angle of approach we could take to those to get that rate below 10%, and thoughts about what the risk the utility is if we did that.
What one thing worth mentioning is that you have teed up the administrative cost allocations that come from electric. We do have a process underway, a review underway with PricewaterhouseCoopers to review those cost allocations. So that could likely turn into some good news
not bad
for news. Water.
I think you will go the other way.
But, you know, to your point, if that's sitting out there and we want to take a different, you know, kind of wait and see how that lands and, you know, that's one small piece of it.
Yeah. But, you know, 1% is $150,000. $150,000 on the electric side would be the width pencil in. I'm just wondering if there's a way to, it's still, you know, a 9% rate increase would be a very large rate increase. It just seems hard to swallow
a
double digit rate increase.
It is. But, you know, generally speaking, our water here is relatively cheap. And I think people need to they're going to have to tighten their belts and maybe take fewer showers. I know that might be off topic, but when I think about people just not valuing water, and we in Edmonds, of course, we have a big chunk of our water bill is for our stormwater runoff and treatment and all of that. But our bill is like a couple hundred dollars a month. And so I'm not complaining because I realize it's not all for water. And it is coming from Spader Lake through Alderwood.
Ironically, it starts out as our water.
Pardon?
Ironically, it starts out as our water. And then we get to buy it.
I don't know. We have to adjust.
I understand what you're saying.
I will say that the water utility has taken a very conservative approach for quite some time. Over the years from 2017, 2017 and then 2019 through 2021, we held back on doing any rate increases at all. We had no rate increases those years for various reasons. And we did know that we were not going to be able to sustain that. And we do try to stay very conservative. But again, our system maintenance to ensure the overall integrity of the system infrastructure, water quality regulations, and decreasing any other main breaks and emergencies, and going through with our main replacements, and the requirement for the need for FTEs is driving quite a bit of this.
Point, Commissioner Logan, or potential concept on a floor kind of glide path. That is the board's decision if you want to extend the term or the time in which we get to that new reserves target of 150 days cash on hand.
And that, yeah,
it's just an approach.
I appreciate that. And I guess my question is for you, what impact, if any, is that likely to have on us, our bond ratings, those kinds of things? I mean, that's why we're on that approach. Customers don't care what our reserves are.
No, that's for
we're doing it so that we can continue to, you know, secure low cost bonds.
Well, I could take a stab at an answer on that, but I would I might as well utilize my term limited CFO to
phone friend.
I'm going to work you this last week, dude.
Yeah. If you can't get another storm in before you.
Right. Yeah. Scott Jones, PUD's current chief financial officer. I don't think that we're looking at a significant impact. I think we want to find that sweet spot where we get the reserves to the point where it's comfortable on the ratepayer, it's comfortable on the commission, but it also holds on to enough that we can maintain that credit rating, because water is going to be going into the market for, you know, for debt under a construction plan here over the next several years. And so I don't think we want to do too much damage to that. The nice part about water is it's within the broader structure of the PUD, and so it does reap some spillover benefits of being a part of a broader organization. And so, yeah, no pun intended. I think you're on good footing to slow that phase in down a little bit if you want. We wanted to do it in 3 or 4 years. We pushed it out to that 5 or 6 year number. We can extend it further and see how the next 2 or 3 years go. And I don't think you're going to harm yourself. Worst case scenario, if you did see a decline in credit quality by a notch, there's a price to that. I don't think it's a catastrophic price. I think it's a pretty small price. And so nobody on the financial side of the world wants a downgrade, but your safety net here for that good credit quality is still there.
So that's talking about slowing down the reserve growth.
Right.
What if we slow down the administrative cost, right? If we reduce the administrative cost burden for next year, $150,000,
yeah,
it's not like we'd be looking at a 9.75%.
Yeah, the challenge with that one is we've got a fairness doctrine there that we've got to try to live by on allocation of overhead costs. That's crept up a little bit since I've been here, just because of that fairness doctrine, us trying to come up with a logical calculation. My suggestion on that one would be, and John mentioned this, we've embarked on a pretty good study here with PricewaterhouseCoopers. Our plan is to have that model in place in the summer and put 6 months worth of actuals into that model and test drive it to see how things shake out, and then layer that into the 2026 budgeting process. So from a cost allocation standpoint, making too many drastic moves there without an underlying model that our auditors and stuff like is a little bit riskier. And so we've got a cost allocation. It's been looked at by auditors in the past. I would probably leave that one alone without making any subjective movements in it. There might be, I'd be optimistic, there might be some downward pressure on that allocation to water after this modeling. At least that's kind of the early indication from Sean, our controller. But phasing in the reserves and then, you know, at least you know, giving yourself a good shake at cost, you know, cost containment as Jeff and Christina get into the year next year, a couple of ways you can do it. We do this on the electric side, right? We don't try to overcorrect on some of the cost allocations until we see how the revenue shakes out. And once we get some clarity on revenue, we can be a little more flexible too. So they've got management flexibility going into 2025 as well.
But if the cost allocation comes back with an answer that's a smaller number, that really won't really affect them for 25 all the time.
No, but it'd take a lot of pressure off of 26. It could, I mean, we're not planning on layering it in 25, but it would take some pressure off of 26. So, you know, don't forget, this is a rate increase context of a five-year forecast. So I wouldn't look at it as a one-year, you know, I know you're approving 1 year, but it's within the context of that broader.
Right. And yeah, we have next year's pretty big number too.
True. Right.
Well, the commissioners, I for one would like to look at a model that's less than 10%. I don't know what your thoughts are.
It's reasonable.
And come back and maybe have a conversation. Do we have time, John, to do that?
I would look to Jeff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff shaking his head affirmative. So, yeah, we can bring you back a couple different options that would put that 25 rate increase below 10% and kind of see how that looks, what levers we can pull to make that happen.
Richard, also, what are your thoughts?
So what does that save the customer in terms of dollars? 50 cents.
Yeah, if you're just targeting under the 10%, it's would be a pretty small average
impact. Yeah, that's
given the total.
I agree with you. We've done a lot of double digit years. But that's you're only cutting the cost by 50 cents, right?
Yeah, you save 1%. And the average increases $5-6, you're in the 60 cent range.
Yeah, and for the average customer, which not everyone is, so, you know, this is the difference when we're talking about the electrical rate increase, it's all going to the fixed charge.
Mm-hmm.
So you can tell somebody your cost is going to go up exactly 20, whatever cents it is. This is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And I do appreciate that we haven't increased and we made a choice not to increase water rates. So I hadn't forgotten that as we got here and the irony of that. And
that's why we're looking at this.
I understand.
I have a kind of a comment for Jeff. I hope that you will make it a high priority to lead the way toward water conservation, because we're doing it on the energy side in lots of ways, several ways. And people waste water, so much water, and they have to, pardon me, they have to be made more aware of the value. I'm repeating myself, the value of water. It's not nothing.
No, that's point well made. And
your showers, your daughter, you've talked about it.
Exactly. A huge impact.
Well, I'm guilty too. You know, I love a long hot shower.
But that is one of the benefits, significant benefits of the
I know, the smart meters.
Yeah. Actually, so, we'll provide the customers that info and see the impacts that it's having by financially for them conserving water.
And so that's my regrets.
You know, the other piece that would be useful next time is we've had several, we've been passing on the City of Everett's cost every year, and it is now singling it out. It would be helpful to look at that cumulative effect of the last few years when we haven't had rate increases. How much, because part of this 8.5% or whatever, that 8.25%, it's absorbing those over the last several years too. Just I'm thinking about how we communicate this to the public also. We've been paying Everett
water every year, but haven't necessarily passed it on or singled it out.
Yeah, we haven't singled it out, which we had talked about over the last couple of years to really make that, create that awareness. We can go back and take a look at those numbers and the impacts. I do think we have made that into the increases that we have had for water.
Right, we have, but yeah.
But the cumulative effect could look a little different and tell another narrative.
And you're grasping the throat. Okay, well, I'm not sure we have a consensus here. Commissioner Wolf, you indicated that you'd be interested in looking at a model that came back at less than 10%. Commissioner Olson, I'm not sure.
Well, I'm not unhappy with what's recommended.
Okay.
I'm really not. I'm just saying if that's what you want, I wouldn't fight it.
Okay.
I wouldn't oppose it. So.
I'll just add, so we do have the January 7th meeting to come back and talk with the decision on the meeting that follows. So we do have time the January 7th to bring additional information to inform your decision on the 21st. So,
okay. Well, it sounds like two of us are.
What I would say is.
I'm not going to go there. I have a different perspective. And this is consistent with what the board approved months ago in terms of taking a look at the water utility and the need for better reserves and again, the true cost of service. But bring it back.
It's completely consistent with that, and that's not lost to me too. We approved the the administrative cost rate, and it's just that it's costing us more to get that reserve where we need it, much more in the water department, which is a small percent of our total cost.
Yeah,
but it's a big impact if you're a water customer.
Yeah, and at the risk of trying to play peacemaker here, we can, the easiest, probably most effective lever is to just extend that reserve target out. We can bring back, if the board would like to see, what that could look like, and depending on how far we want to push that out, and that, that's a risk decision that you would have to make, then that means we can adjust that number more than 1% in the first year, and then just put that glide path or put a couple options together of what that glide path would look like, going beyond a 5-year target to the 150 days cash on hand. We can do that.
And I guess there's a chance the cash on hand will go up anyway if we can't spend all of our budget dollars.
Yeah, don't bet on that anymore.
Okay.
I bet on that
for several years.
And yeah, I threw down that gauntlet now I'm buying steak dinner. So,
okay. Okay, well, it sounds like there's a weak consensus to Jeff to come back and look at an under 10% number and the understand the impacts.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even call it an under 10%. I would term it as you just extending, wanting to look at the potential of extending that day's cash on hand out and see the impacts that will have. Make sense?
Yes, it does. Cool. Good concern.
Any other questions or
any other questions, commissioners, or comments?
I have none.
Thank you. Great presentation. Hope you're feeling better, Christina.
Thank you.
All right. Last one for the morning. Cost of service analysis and preliminary rate design. Peter Dahmenhauer and Christina Langweber. Good morning. I thought you were running out of your room here.
Just relocating. Good morning, commissioners. Peter Downer, Senior Manager of Rates, Economics, Energy Risk Management, joined today by Christina Leinweber, our rates expert here at the district. And for the record, I was just relocating over here because I've been sitting behind the podium and I can't read the room very well back there. So I'm going to move over there because I'm going to be introducing this presentation a little bit, and Christina's going to be handling most of it. So Let's get into it. The purpose of this presentation is to present the rate options that were based off of our cost of service from the 2025 to 2029 budget and forecast. This is informational only. And our agenda is to do a little bit of review on our cost of service and then look at our potential rate adjustments, residential, commercial, and other rate designs, and get into any sort of questions or discussion that we need to have. And then we'll discuss next steps at the end. So a little bit longer presentation this time, but hopefully you'll appreciate we're getting into the details of the rate designs themselves here. Where we've come from, started out on October 7th with our 2025 budget public hearing, and we've shown the cost of service results, talked a little bit about the rate design philosophy, and looked at rate adjustment options last meeting we had, and today getting into the details. We'll be opening a public hearing starting January 7th and requesting commission approval on the rates on January 21st. With the new rates being effective April 1st, 2025. Okay, at this point, I'll hand it off to Christina.
Thank you, Peter. So to remind the commission and anybody that may be following along, what happened on our previous episode of Make an Electric Rate, here we have in some of those, the first step of making the electric rates is setting the revenue requirement. And that comes to the budget, and we have a 4.6 system average rate increase. And then what we've been working on for the last few meetings was how we divide that between the various customers. And last time the board considered a menu of options of different ways we could do that, and they settled on option C, which included a 4.9% residential increase and other commercial industrial increases, as shown here from last time, the recommendation by the commission. And so now the question is, how do we actually implement those in prices and our actual unit for a month, a day, a kilowatt, whatever we're billing the customer? And that's our discussion for today. The largest rate class we have is the residential rate class. And as I sort of hinted in last session, and as also seemed to be agreeably received by the commission at that time, these figures show what it would look like to put that 4.9% class rate increase into the daily fixed charge. So the vast majority of our customers are here in these small and medium size customers. So we're seeing an increase of between 13 and 21 cents per day for the vast majority of our customers. And this is very nice also because it limits the amount of the increase for the customers, regardless of their usage, and it helps our alignment with our cost of service analysis.
A quick question on this slide. So it dawned on me, we were having conversations previously about what schools are paying, what other kinds of businesses are paying. We've lumped a lot of commercial customers mm-hmm. into big groups. This one we've really divided down pretty finely. Are the others divided down like this? This small, medium, large, extra large?
At this time, we just have one fixed charge for the various kinds of commercial classes. Something we're interested in with AMI is looking at if we can make more granular distinctions in those classes. For commercial customers, the more common division is to do it based on demand or based on load factor. And so AMI will really help us have more visibility into how the customers in those classes are different or the same. So we do anticipate, we will be looking at that, and we may come to the commission with requests to merge or to divide customer classes in the commercial space once we have some greater visibility into them.
And this is just a comment. When we had this last time, our message was a little confusing about the percent increase. And really, for most residential customers, this is just going to be a 21 cent day increase.
Yes.
And I hope we think about when we communicate that we keep it simple, because it really is simple. It's not going up a percentage.
Yeah.
For an average customer, it's going up an exact amount for every customer.
Yeah, great point. Lesson learned from last year. And we will be really focused on how we make the communication of the rate increase as simple and straightforward as possible.
Yeah.
Right.
When they all step
in. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely right. Great.
Thank you. We are in line. We are currently at the lower end of the rate increase, as or the lower end of the residential, you know, fixed base charges for our peer utilities. And we're definitely not alone in increasing our fixed charges. That's something that all utilities across the country are doing, because all utilities across the country are seeing some of those same cost of service issues. So we think that we're very much in line there. And we also, you know, think that they impact us, as Commissioner Logan noted. We're right. These impacts will be fixed for each customer. So this is for a 30-day month, but yes, right in this amount here. So everybody knows what they can expect. We are hoping to do one of other cleanup with the residential class. We have a little bit of a legacy artifact in our rate code right now, which is to have a low income rate that is infinitesimally smaller than our regular rate. And this was based on how we used to do our low income assistance many years ago. At this time, we're providing substantial low income assistance from our discount program instead, as a we think a more effective program than trying to have a low income rate. And so we've been slowly stepping the low income rate closer and closer to the regular rate, and we'll hope to bring them to convergence right now, since again they're so close finally. And so that will also be a great simplification for our programming and billing people as well. Now we move into our commercial rate designs, which are a little more complex, and where we're really trying to prepare the ground for the future and some of those things that I mentioned before about combining rates or separating rates, or also having time dynamic rates and some of the things that we'll be able to have with AMI. And so we have in our rate code a legacy of some previous cost of service rate designs and previous ways that the utility costs fell out, which is in a number of our rate classes, we have a block rate where there's one price for the first 30,000 kilowatt hours, and then a different price for the second 30,000 kilowatt hours. And we're very unique in utilities right now, is it's actually a declining block. So those costs for those additional higher usages of power is actually lower than the first block of power. And this rate design made a lot of sense when the utility was long in power, and where we were really, many utilities had these designs at the very beginning of electric utility space when they just built the, you know, higher system and they had plenty of excess capacity and wanted to use it. It doesn't make so much sense now. And so we would like to, again, start walking this to a simpler rate design and one that's more reflective of our current cost of service. And that will also make a better springboard for when we start introducing rates that are enabled by AMI. We'll have a much simpler baseline for customers to then ask if they want to go into the more complicated time dynamic rates. And so for the medium general service here, it is a little bit confusing to look at the percentages here, because we'll be lowering that lower tier of rates, but raising those higher tiers of rates to a convergence. And so the net effect of all those changes will be the 3.6% increase across the customer class as a whole. But of course, during different months, different effects will be visible. And that they will net out over time.
This looks like it's could potentially impact a lot of customers and a lot more than the average if they go into the second tier. We have many customers that do.
Yes, we do have customers that go into the second tier, and they will be impacted. There will be a dispersion of impacts on the customer, but it's really in line with the cost of service. These customers have been getting. If they over index on the sixth sense, if they use a lot of power during that second tier spring, they've really been paying below their cost of service for a long time. So bringing them up to a much more reflective cost basis will be a little bit of a jump for some of those, but it is more equitable within the class. Any other questions? Our small general service, we're bringing the energy charge to be consistent with the general service charge, which is part of our rate design philosophy, is to make it that smooth between those two classes. So if customers grow and move from one to the other, or if they shrink, then that move is smooth. And then putting in more into the base charge, which is, again, a theme. That is going, you will see again. And then we have also something we call it's a legacy time of use rate. It is not very highly subscribed for our customers. This rate is currently above cost of service, and so we intend to have a 0% rate increase for this rate. But we want to do the same thing that we're doing to all other rates, which is bring them to this more simplified design. And so for the customer that is in this rate, they will be paying significantly less in their first tier and more in their other tiers, but it's going to net to zero for them. And since there's only one customer on this rate, you can just look at their, we were able to look at their bills and see how that would work.
And again, just like on the medium class of customers, the declining block philosophy or program that we've had on is diametrically opposed to energy conservation. I mean, I remember seeing this, shame on me that we hadn't noticed this before, or I hadn't noticed it and we hadn't addressed it. Something I was very used to in the IOU world, where they are all in on people buying more of their product. But for us and our model, and especially our focus on energy conservation, it does not align.
Well, I looked at that, I was thinking of not going away from slice, and often to let me have excess energy in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
That was from our perspective also. That was back in those days, yes. That was definitely the thought behind having the spring rate. But moving to the new product, moving to the new world that we're in, this no longer makes sense. And that's why it's important to keep doing cost of service every year. You just can't set it and forget it because things change.
Yeah, and really, not to go too deep in this, but from a philosophy standpoint, we were giving benefit to certain classes for having that slice product that other classes were not getting, right? We sell that on the open market, then we allocate those revenues back across all rate classes. Here, this was one rate class benefit.
And then we have the much smaller classes here, the special continuous service, where we're going to put all into the base charge. Again, these are things like wireless pole attachments and so forth. And now we move into the industrial rate designs. Luckily, these were already a little bit closer to cost of service in their design already, so we don't have to do some of the rewiring that we're proposing for the commercial rate design. Instead, we're proposing to have a slight increase for both the demand charge and the energy charge in Schedule 36. And you can see for each of our customers, the proposed rate design will have a 5 to 5.2% projected increase for each individual customer. So they're all nicely clustering around the desired class increase. And then we do have on our books a schedule for large transmission service. We don't currently have any customers based on the movie, however. So it's a little more of a theoretical or indicative rate than an actual rate that any customers are currently receiving. Our rates still remain in the central portion of the statewide rates in our area. We've put down there we see with our green rate in the middle portion there. And so we hope that if the board does not have any additional concerns or suggestions or desires to revise those rates, that we open the public hearing at the next meeting and then continue through the end of that month with getting them approved so that we can actually implement them on April 1st, as is our custom. And then we have the appendix explaining once more all the rates and then having the lighting rates and the EV rates, which are very long tariffs there that I can certainly address if you have questions about those tariffs. But we won't go through every line if there are any questions.
Any questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything else, Colin?
Not seeing anything else on Don's script here. So
there shouldn't be. Okay, it is now 11:04 a.m. and the board will recess into executive session to discuss current or potential litigation under the terms set forth in the Public Meetings Act. The anticipated executive session will last 60 minutes and will conclude at, I would say, 12:05. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.